Funding for NJ Spotlight News provided by the members of the New Jersey Education Association. Making public schools great for every child. RWJ Barnabas Health. Let's be healthy together. And New Jersey Realtors, the voice of real estate in New Jersey. More information is online at njrealtor.com.
Tonight on NJ Spotlight News, Trump on trial. A jury in the historic hush money case is set to decide the fate of the former president.
This is the first time a former president and a presidential candidate is being criminally prosecuted. Everything is unprecedented.
Plus, educators go door to door in Camden to promote the city's free pre-K program, where right now there are more open seats than students.
Education, you think about it, it has a price tag on it. And it's important to let everybody know that this is free. It's a free program, so it's just get your kids involved.
Also, the state's creating a community-based crisis response team so no one dies by the police during a mental health crisis. And preventing opioid addiction in young athletes, former NFL player Ray Lucas shares his struggle off the field battling addiction.
I'm paying it back, and in addiction, you have to pay it back. You cannot get what I got and then not share it.
NJ Spotlight News begins right now.
From NJPBS Studios, this is NJ Spotlight News with Brianna Vinozzi.
Good evening and thanks for joining us. I'm Joanna Gagas in for Brianna Vinozzi on this Friday night. The first week of former President Donald Trump's criminal hush money trial in New York City has come to a close, and it's been an eventful week. Just as the announcement was made that the jury panel was confirmed, a man outside set himself on fire only 50 feet away from the courthouse. NYPD responded quickly, and that man is now in critical condition. The incident may change security access to the areas outside the courthouse. But inside the court, proceedings continued after 12 jurors and six alternates were finalized. The jury selection process has left many wondering, though, just how impartial jurors can actually be in this case, given the high-profile nature of the defendant, and whether it was possible to weed out any hidden motives that jurors may have. It's also led to concerns about the safety of these jurors, as the former president continues to defy a gag order placed on him by Judge Juan Merchan, Trump calling that gag order unfair this morning. Prosecutors are expected to begin laying out their case against the former president on Monday, and this jury now carries the burden of deciding the fate of Donald Trump and whether he could be the first U.S. president to face jail time. I'm joined now by former federal prosecutor Chris Germiccioni to talk about all of it. Chris Germiccioni, great to have you with us, as always. Now, we see right now a jury panel confirmed, and arguments could start as early as Monday. Is this the speed that you would have expected the jury selection process to take?
I personally thought it would take anywhere between 1 and 2 weeks, so it's a lot faster than I anticipated. But I guess the court and the judge in particular is doing a good job at expediently facilitating the review of each of the juries. So they got a jury in the box. That's a great start in less than a week.
Yeah, it has felt pretty quick. Now, I will mention Judge Merchan has admonished some members of the media for putting out identifying features of the jurors. We are not going to do that, but I can say that there's a real mix of backgrounds here. We see attorneys, educators, therapists. Do you feel confident that the prosecution, that the defense attorneys have been able to find a jury panel that's actually unbiased, that they've been able to possibly weed out any potential biases that exist?
I think that each party, they can only operate on what the answers for each of the jurors that were put on the jury had said. You know, they're going to be sworn in. They'll be under oath to carry out their duties faithfully and impartially. And part of those duties is to listen to the evidence and consider it and remain fair and impartial and judge the case only on the evidence presented. So I have to presume that the criminal justice system is going to work. That is our system. It's the best one in the world. And you got to believe that each of those jurors, what they told the court, what they told the parties representing both the defendant, President Trump, and of course the city, that they're going to ring true to that oath that they're going to take. So, yeah, hope springs eternal.
We did see one juror criticize the judge for not stopping or interceding in his dismissal. Is that par for the course in the court proceedings? Should the judge have intervened if one side or the other wanted to dismiss?
I the judge kind of controls that courtroom like a referee. And he can decide whether or not he wants to do something like that. And I don't see anything offensive or improper about that. I think the real challenge is you're really trying to size up each of the jurors before they're put on the in the box. You want to size them up and ensure that they're going to review that evidence faithfully and impartially.
So arguments could start on Monday. The judge has not ordered the prosecution to identify who their first witnesses will be. And he says they make a good case that Trump has been tweeting about the witnesses. And so it could come as a surprise to the defense. How unconventional have these court proceedings been so far? Do you expect them to continue to be unconventional?
Well, just by the very nature of it, that this is the first time a former president and a presidential candidate is being criminally prosecuted, everything is unprecedented. Yeah. So I everything, they're kind of breaking new ground as you go forward each day. It's a standard practice to be able to disclose witnesses and, an exhibit list, but it's not mandated or required under New York state practice. So it's discretionary on the part of the district attorney's office, and they've chosen not to do that. So the judge doesn't really have a role in whether he can force that.
And this could be the first time that we see a former president who faces criminal charges who could be found guilty. What could that look like for him if he is found guilty?
Well, the penalties could range, from, a heavy fine up to incarceration. In practice, there isn't a lot of case precedents on a prosecution like this. It would be difficult for me to envision, if there is a conviction, that it would carry some kind of a jail time, especially for a former president. The district attorney's office carries the burden of proving the case beyond a reasonable doubt, and it requires unanimity in the jury. It just takes one juror to disagree to hang that jury, or alternatively, all the jury members could agree that the district attorney's office hasn't made their case. So it's up in the air.
It sure is. Chris Carmiccioni, great to have you on as always. Thank you.
Hey, likewise. Have a good weekend.
U.S. Senator Bob Menendez will now have a one-week delay to the start of his bribery trial. Lawyers agreed an additional week would aid in trial preparation, so Judge Sidney Stein moved the start date from May 6th to May 13th. The senator and his wife have been charged in a bribery scheme that included gold bars, cash, and a luxury vehicle that were allegedly traded for political favors. Last week, the judge agreed to split their trials and delay Nadine Menendez's trial until July because of an undisclosed health issue. Each one of us could be one prescription away from an opioid addiction. That's the message from former NFL player Ray Lucas, who spoke today at a conference in Atlantic City put on by the Partnership for a Drug-Free New Jersey. Lucas shared his story of overcoming an opioid addiction after leaving the NFL. And as Ted Goldberg reports, he warns of the pitfalls that can face other young athletes struggling with pain.
I'm not afraid of any man, gun, knife. You could bring anything you want to me. I'll step right to you. But I am afraid of a little circle hill, like I'll run for the hills.
When Ray Lucas played in the NFL, painkillers helped him through the hurt that came with an 8-year career.
You do what you have to do to stay on the field. If you're in the training room, you're in danger.
After graduating from Rutgers and playing professionally, Lucas says he got addicted to opiates almost immediately after retiring.
I had a serious back injury. I had 4 and 5 fused together with a 2-inch steel plate, 4 screws, and they took 3 completely out. I've had 7 spinal fusions.
He's spoken about his struggles for more than 2 years, and his latest stop was the Golden Nugget in Atlantic City. Lucas was one of the speakers at a conference hosted by Partnership for a Drug-Free New Jersey, focused on preventing young athletes from becoming addicted to opioids.
It's scientifically proven that adolescents are 10 times more likely to become addicted than grown men. I was a grown man when I became addicted, and it happened like that.
Youth athletes are prone to injuries, and because of that, they are at a greater risk of being prescribed an addictive opiate.
Experts presented grim statistics about the opioid epidemic, even as more people are aware of risks, and Narcan has become more available.
It's the leading cause of death for Americans between the ages of 18 and 45. And if you think about that, if you break that down per day, over 112,000 Americans dying, that's Over 300 people a day are dying.
I'm very much of a holistic person, so I completely disagree with how doctors prescribed opioids. It's such a strong medication, and like we saw today, like, it is killing so many people. And I feel, with as a physical therapist, it's very holistic, as you're using exercise as a form of medication.
Melanie Gerardo is a student at Felician University and came here with some of her classmates. When told a lot of young people get addicted from dental treatment, Gerardo had personal experience with that.
I had gotten my wisdom teeth taken out, and my doctor actually prescribed me opioids, but being that I was a minor, my mom didn't let me. So because she said no, I actually didn't end up taking the opioids. Instead, I took ibuprofen, and I had no pain because I was taking ibuprofen.
Your doctors, when they prescribe you an opioid, because they really don't understand the risks and benefits, and your mom may have, by telling you not to take that prescription, may have saved your life.
There was some good news from today. Brandeis University professor Andrew Kolodny says in recent years, fewer infants are born with opioid dependency, though it's leveled off a bit since the pandemic. As for Lucas, he says he'll continue speaking to young people about the dangers of opioids.
I'm paying it back. And in addiction, you have to pay it back. You cannot get what I got and then not share it. I was conditioned my whole life not to ask for anything. If you can't go get it yourself, then you don't deserve to have it. My saying now is, when you ask for help, that's courage.
And Lucas will keep sharing his message to anyone who wants to listen. In Atlantic City, I'm Ted Goldberg, NJ Spotlight News.
Support for the medical report is provided by Horizon Blue Cross Blue Shield of New Jersey, an independent licensee of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
After two New Jersey men experiencing mental health crises died during police responses last year, there's been a growing push for more investment into crisis response teams. This week, Governor Murphy and New Jersey Attorney General Matt Platkin announced $12 million in funding to create a new response model called the Community Crisis Response Pilot Program. Melissa Rose Cooper spoke with community groups around the state about what this funding will mean for their crisis response teams.
I feel that New Jersey is currently leading the way nationally on how states are reimagining public safety. And with investments like this, we're going to continue that trajectory.
Lisa Chowdhury, executive director for the Patterson Healing Collective, applauding Governor Murphy and State Attorney General Matt Platkin's recent announcement that they'll be dedicating up to $12 million in funding for the Community Crisis Response Team pilot program. The initiative is a result of legislation signed earlier this year that's named after Andrew Washington and Najee Seabrooks, who were both killed by police while experiencing mental health crises.
This legislation, why it's so important, and you know that this is close to our heart, we want to avoid incidents like what happened last year from ever happening again. And this grant provides critical funding that can help us build that infrastructure locally. This legislation is going to provide additional resources to support individuals and communities that may benefit most from additional community-led trauma-informed services and resources.
The AG's office noting the program will complement other resources already in place to ensure responses to calls for help are handled appropriately, like Arrive Together, which is now operational in all 21 counties. Tiffany Wilson, who serves as the director of the Office of Alternative and Community Responses, adding in the announcement, the addition of community partners to the currently available response options provides another pathway to needed resources while reducing burdens on law enforcement agencies and improving public safety and health outcomes.
It's imperative that the governor, that the AG, that the mayor, that council folks in these cities address these issues that face our community. And we have to start reimagining what real public safety looks like. You know, now here in America, we criminalize everything. We criminalize immigration, we criminalize mental health. When we look at the number one institutions in this country that are housing mental health patients, it's prison.
Tracy Syfix agrees the funding will help improve how mental health crises are treated and says those closest to the problem also tend to be closer to the solution.
When you look at, you know, Najee Seabrook and how he died, here he is, a member of the Patterson Healing Collective, you know, that street team up in Patterson, whereas that they had an opportunity. That standoff lasted over 4 hours. They had an opportunity to call in the people that Najee worked with, his counterparts, his street team. They had the opportunity to call them in order to quell that situation, and they didn't. And in the end result of that, Najee is not with us anymore. So having an opportunity now and recognizing you know, through just that alone, you know, having folks who are capable of dealing with mental health issues, but people that actually know our community also is very helpful.
The program will award eligible community-based organizations up to $2 million through a competitive grant process. Crisis response teams in Camden, Essex, Mercer, Middlesex, Hudson, and Passaic counties can apply. But social advocates say this is just the first step.
It's still a mere drop in the bucket compared to what's currently allocated to law enforcement agencies throughout the state. We need to see the state continue to increase the level of funding for these teams, supporting things like staff retention and training and resources for those who are doing this incredibly important and sacred work.
Advocates say they'd also like to see the funding become a fixed item in the state budget so successful results of crisis response teams can be seen well into the future. For NJ Spotlight News, I'm Melissa Rose Cooper.
Full-day pre-K is a key priority of the Murphy administration in this year's budget, and many school districts are working to expand their programs as the funding comes in. While in the city of Camden, free full-day preschool is available for 3- and 4-year-olds, but not enough parents know about it. Raven Santana accompanied education leaders and advocates as they went door-to-door in Camden neighborhoods, informing families about this early education opportunity.
Camden City School District Superintendent Katrina McCombs and more than 50 volunteers hit the streets to promote enrolling 3- and 4-year-olds in the district's free full-day preschool programs.
Because even though we have billboards plastered throughout the city in Spanish and in English, we have social media that we keep alive and we shine a light on it, there's nothing like knocking on a door and having a personal human conversation with a parent who may not know anything about early childhood.
The state's universal preschool programs are full-day programs that have a certificated teacher and aide. There are limited class sizes and a curriculum aligned to the New Jersey Preschool Teaching and Learning Standards. The program is also inclusive to special needs children. In an effort to make sure families were taking advantage of the programs, members of the school board and the early childhood team began canvassing any and every door around the McGuire Gardens apartments located in the East Camden area.
We have about 1,000 slots that we're looking to fill for next school year. Our main round has already opened and closed, and so we have quite a few applicants that have already registered for our program for next school year, so we're looking for a few hundred more, about 500 or 600 more.
And volunteers I spoke with, as you can see behind me, who have continued to knock on doors throughout the afternoon, stress that the process is so quick and easy that they want it to remain with parents and guardians to help them complete the enrollment process on site.
Do you think this is a way to go for not just you, people around here?
Yes.
Why so?
Because some people be applying and be on the waiting list for a long time and stuff like that. And they got jobs and stuff, so, and they want to get their kids in school or trying to find a job.
And will you be taking advantage of it now?
Yes.
COVID has really done a number on us, but I'm sure some parents who don't know. And, you know, education, you think about it, it has a price tag on it. And it's important to let everybody know that this is free. It's a free program, so it's just get your kids involved. It's free, and we want to make sure that the information is being spread.
Camden is one of 238 New Jersey school districts that receive state funding for universal preschool programs. According to the National Institute for Early Education Research annual State of Preschool Report, 58,000 children are currently enrolled in those programs. The report says New Jersey ranked 21st in the nation for preschool enrollment for 4-year-olds and 4th for 3-year-olds. Governor Murphy has set a goal for universal pre-K for all 3- and 4-year-olds by 2030.
Our report this year finds that state-funded preschool has bounced back from the pandemic. Across the nation, we hit new highs.
Steve Barnett is co-director of the National Institute for Early Education Research at Rutgers University. Barnett says universal pre-K isn't just a game changer for parents and students, it's also good for the economy.
Percentage of 4-year-olds, percentage of 3-year-olds enrolled, new highs for spending, including spending per child, new highs for quality standards. So that's great news, and we should be congratulating our states for bouncing back from the recession. Of course, that was very uneven Right? Every state didn't bounce back in the same way.
Barnett says more needs to be done to expand universal pre-K across the state. Volunteers say they plan to knock on doors like today in different parts of the city every Thursday throughout the summer. For NJ Spotlight News, I'm Raven Santana.
In our Spotlight on Business report tonight, the debate rages on about how to create more affordable housing in the state, but there's a new movement to create what's called accessory dwelling units, or ADUs. Think mother-in-law suite, but for a stranger. And as senior correspondent Brenda Flanagan tells us, some towns are passing ordinances to allow these ADUs as a way to get more affordable options in their towns without all the controversy of large affordable housing units.
People who don't have money want to have a living space, want it to be nice.
Michelle turned the first floor of her split-level Princeton home into a one-bedroom apartment, thinking maybe family could stay here during visits. But 6 years later, she's renting it out at below-market rates as an affordable accessory dwelling unit, or ADU.
We need a diverse community. People who work here can't live here, et cetera, because the prices are so, so, so high. So we decided to renovate our house.
These have been used as mother-in-law units, au pair suites. They have been cottages that people had in their back, caretaker cottages. They've existed for so many years.
Architect Marina Rubina helped Michelle design the $30,000 renovation. She specializes in ADUs, which can be built into existing homes over a garage or in Princeton as a separate, smaller dwelling.
On the same property as a single-family home. And what it means is that the property is not subdivided. It's one property and it has two dwelling units.
If somebody wanted to like have the main house for themselves, they could. And if they had in-laws or parents, grandparents, they could, you know, have the smaller house for them. Mm-hmm. In Princeton, you can sell both houses separately.
Developer Moise Tayebele is building a large house and an ADU on the same lot. The ADU must have a kitchen and a bathroom and no more than two bedrooms. With a 250,000 unit affordable housing deficit in New Jersey, ADUs offer what housing advocates call gentle density.
Gentle density, like accessory dwelling units, is density that is not all at once. It gradually creates more housing over time. It doesn't overwhelm any infrastructure or schools. And quite frankly, it doesn't change the visual character of a town in any way.
Princeton's one of just a handful of New Jersey towns, including Montclair and Maplewood, that have adopted ordinances enabling ADUs. But Governor Murphy and lawmakers want to expand the initiative statewide.
They're also usually offered at a more affordable rental price than market rate. So it truly is an opportunity to have affordable housing, too, in the community.
Brittany Timberlake's co-sponsoring a bill that would set statewide standards for ADUs. It requires municipalities to allow accessory dwellings with limited exceptions, ban selling ADUs separately from the primary residence, and requires towns promote ADU construction to meet affordable housing demands. The bill's getting some pushback from towns worried about preserving single-family home neighborhoods.
There are some concerns from some of the municipalities. You know, they want to be able to opt out of this, but then what's the point of the legislation? You can do things to make sure that it fits for your community.
Governor Murphy's proposed budget includes $10 million in municipal grants for a statewide ADU pilot project. The AARP is fully behind the idea to help retired folks afford to age in place. Michelle's counting on that.
So that when we retired, we would be able to take in a little extra income.
As for this new ADU, it's expected to list for about $1 million, which in Princeton is apparently considered affordable. I'm Brenda Flanagan, NJ Spotlight News.
Turning to Wall Street, stocks slide for a sixth straight day. Here's how the markets closed for the week. And make sure to tune into NJ Business Beat with Raven Santana this weekend. She's focused on New Jersey's transportation future. First, looking at how NJ Transit and Rutgers are developing AI technology to keep you safe on the tracks. Then, why New Jerseyans are giving the governor's electric vehicle push mixed reviews. Watch it Saturday at 5 p.m. and Sunday morning at 9:30 on NJ PBS. That does it for us tonight, but make sure you check out Chatbox with David Cruz this weekend. David looks at the state's climate goals and whether New Jersey's falling short in meeting them. Catch it Saturday night at 6:30 and Sunday morning at 10:30 on NJPBS. And on Reporters Roundtable this week, David talks with Senate Republican leader Anthony Bucco about the GOP's take on the state budget, Oprah, and the court rulings on the party line. Then a panel of local reporters break down the week's political headlines. Watch it Saturday at 6 p.m. and Sunday morning at 10 on NJPBS. I'm Joanna Gagas for the entire NJ Spotlight News team. Thanks for being with us. Enjoy your weekend, and we'll see you back here on Monday.
NJM Insurance Group, serving the insurance needs of residents and businesses for more than 100 years. Horizon Blue Cross Blue Shield of New Jersey, an independent licensee of the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association. New Jersey Realtors, the voice of real estate in New Jersey. More information is online at njrealtor.com and by the PSCG Foundation.
Our future relies on more than clean energy. Our future relies on empowered communities, the health and safety of our families and neighbors, of our schools and streets. The PSEG Foundation is committed to sustainability, equity, and economic empowerment, investing in parks, helping towns go green, supporting civic centers, scholarships, and workforce development that strengthen our community.